Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today. And I am joined by phone by Corey Moreau. She is an assistant curator in the Department of Zoology at Chicago's Field Museum of Natural History. Corey, thanks so much for joining us today. Hi, Corey.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So, Corey, you are not only the curator of, but also the focus of a current exhibit called The Romance of Ants. And yesterday we had our regular entomologist, Phil Pelletieri, on the show. So insect fans this week are in heaven. When today's topic was mentioned, he said that ants are so sophisticated in the insect world and so fascinating, and they do so many things that we still don't understand. I'm guessing you'd agree with that description.
Absolutely. I mean, the world worldwide, we have about 14,000 species of ants that actually have scientific names. And if we take into account all the ones we know that are new to science out there, there are probably over 30,000 ant species. So knowing something about the biology of all 30,000 is near impossible.
And how does that compare in numbers to other species?
Well, ants are incredibly diverse. I mean, they're you know, far more diverse than things like birds. So if you think of all the birds that are known on the planet, ants outnumber those. There are more than double the species of ants described as all mammals. But in the insect world, they're very diverse, but they are paled in color by things like beetles. Beetles outweigh every group of insects.
So I knew that there were a lot of types of ants, but I'm amazed at, you know, we think of birds as being so distinct and easy to identify. I think a lot of us embarrassedly enough kind of lump ants into ants.
That's right. What
are some of the most interesting species around the world, especially those that you've studied?
Well, I think one of the things that really ties in with the exhibit is that we wanted people to know that there's more than just red and black ants, which is typically how people think about them. They notice them maybe if they're on the sidewalk and definitely when they're in their kitchens. But, you know, so one of the things we've done is highlight just how distinct species can be once you can see them close up. So we use these large color photographs and we highlight things like army ants and leafcutter ants and all kinds of fascinating ants like Dracula ants. And so one of the things that we know ants do is they have a lot of roles in the environment and interact with lots of other species. And so, I mean, I'd be happy to tell you story after story of ants, and I'm happy to do it. You just sort of steer me where you'd like to go with that.
Well, actually, one of my questions was what role or roles they play in environments, and are they always positive roles, or can they also be destructive? What are some good examples of that?
Well, so, you know, if you think about an ant colony or something you see where, you know, they're bubbling up between the sidewalk, or maybe you see in an anthill, the majority of what's going on in an ant's colony or home is actually underground. And so because they're constantly burrowing underneath the soil, ants actually turn more soil than earthworms. So they're incredibly important for aerating the soil across the globe. In addition, ants also disperse the seeds of many plants. So many plants rely heavily on ants to make sure that those seeds are carried away from the host plant so that that new plant will be successful. They also do control the lots of other pest species through predation. So ants are out foraging in the environment, and oftentimes they help keep populations of pest species in control. Now, unfortunately, some ants actually are not necessarily always good in the environment, and those are typically things that are pest species. And so it's not that they're actually always bad. In their home or native environment, they're actually an important part of that in functioning ecosystem. But when they're removed from their native habitat and inadvertently dispersed, usually through human commerce, and catch hold in a new environment, they can become a pest.
It's interesting that you mentioned earthworms and the function of aerating soil, because we actually had some folks on from the forestry department at the Department of Natural Resources here in Wisconsin last week, and they were talking about that, yes, earthworms in the garden and in your yard are great and provide a great service, but they were particularly focused on how destructive earthworms can be in a forest environment. And I'm wondering if that's a similar thing with ants. Do they, you know, in some situations, is that function of aerating soil, do they take it to an extreme in a place that doesn't need it or doesn't want it?
Well, in most cases, not with ants, because they're actually, they're not eating the soil. They're not processing that as their food source. So for populations of ants to become at a point where they're actually, you know, pests, they have to have enough food resources available. And so you can imagine that there's a sort of carrying capacity, if you will, at which there has to be enough prey items and food resources in that forest to support those ants. So once those start to crash, the ants would crash. Mm-hmm. So we don't see that same tie as we have with earthworms, which actually can essentially live their entire life and gain all their nutrition in the soil.
Mm. And so you've mentioned a couple times those ant colonies, whether they're the visible hills or other structures. How do they organize themselves, and does that vary from different types of ants to others?
Well, so typically ant colonies are much like honeybee colonies, where you have a single queen. Who's laying all of the eggs for the entire colony. So she's producing all of those individuals. But also much like a honeybee colony, ant colonies are female-dominated. So what we have are a whole bunch of sisters actually carrying out all of the work within the colony. So every ant you've ever seen out foraging in the environment, carrying soil around, defending their nest, subduing prey items, those are all female. Males and new virgin queens are only produced about once a year, and they both have wings so that they can go on a mating flight. And so males actually never participate in any functioning of the colony. They don't gather food. They don't repair the nest. They don't care for the young. Their only role is to reproduce. So after they've left the nest on a mating flight, males will die within about a week of copulation, where female queens will then fly around in the environment to find a new suitable home place to start her nest. She'll dig down into the soil or under the bark or wherever that species is found, and she'll rip off her wings and start laying hundreds and hundreds of eggs to build up a whole new colony.
Wow, so it's a very finely tuned machine, the ant colony.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And so ants are communicating with each other mostly through things like pheromones, which are essentially sort of like a hormone. It's a way of sort of communicating with scent, if you will, so that they're not visually using many cues, especially if you can imagine that inside an ant nest, it's actually quite dark.
Hmm. Yeah, as you said, most of the activity is going on underground, and we see a significant amount on the ground, but there's even more going on underneath.
That's absolutely right. And so, you know, an example that we use is that if you think about, if we could take all of the vertebrates that are alive on the planet right now, all the cheetahs and pumas and giraffes and elephants and all of those things, and put them on one side of the scale, and we put every ant that's actually alive on the planet on the other side of the scale, the ants would far outweigh all of those vertebrates.
Wow. That's quite a mental picture.
That's right. So ants make up the bulk of the biomass on the planet.
I want to invite our listeners to join in. Are you fascinated by ants or mostly intent on keeping them away from your house or picnic? If you have a question or a comment for Corey Moreau, Assistant Curator in the Department of Zoology at Chicago's Field Museum of Natural History, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email talk@WPR.org, or you can leave a comment or a question on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. We hope you'll join in. Corey, what kind of ants do we generally see in the Midwest region of the U.S., and are there some both native ants and invasive or just not from here ants?
Yeah, so in the United States, we probably have over 1,000 species of ants. But here in the Midwest, we probably have somewhere on the order of about 150, maybe 200 species of ants. Now, most people actually encounter a very limited number of ants. They'll see things like pavement ants, the ones you'll see warring between the cracks of the pavement during the summer. Every now and then, you'll get a pest species into your home. And unfortunately, people do encounter carpenter ants in their mm-hmm. homes as well. But the majority of species actually here in the Midwest and worldwide actually have very beneficial roles in the environment. But, I mean, even from the number of 150 to 200 species here in the Midwest, you can imagine that most people never encounter that diversity. And so usually, you know, we get calls when people find out that, you know, they've seen swarms in their homes or on their kitchen counters or raiding their picnics. But there's actually quite a lot of diversity out there.
And I definitely want to talk about that, but we do have some callers that want to join in. So
Great. Let's
switch over to the phones. And John in Madison has a question. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi there. How are you?
Great. How are you?
Good. Sounds a very interesting program so far.
Great.
I have a question because in my various mowing so far this year, I've noticed colonies of ants in my grass, And so I've been putting, an insecticide on them to get rid of them. Is that maybe the wrong thing to do? I just thought they're actually doing more harm than good, which it sounds like I may be wrong in.
Well, it depends on what species of ant you have. So in some cases, putting, some sort of an insecticide on it may actually not help at all, because if you don't kill that queen, you're actually not going to end that colony, right? So you're essentially just cutting down a few of the workers, the soldiers that are out foraging. The other thing is that, they have very many beneficial roles. So if they're not harming you or biting or stinging you, I'd actually advocate leaving them in your yard. And so one of the things that we have on exhibit is a photograph of a colleague of mine, Dr. Walter Chinkel, who came up with this clever way of looking at what an ant colony looks like below ground. And what he does is he usually pours molten metals, and sometimes he'll use things like dental plaster into an ant colony, and then digs up the three-dimensional structure below ground. And what you find is that most of the time an ant colony can go anywhere from about a foot or 3 feet all the way down to sometimes 9 or 10 feet below the ground. So really, even though what we're seeing above ground is, a little bit of activity, the majority of which is actually happening below ground.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd want to do that in my grass.
It could be a nice lawn ornament, though, after it's finished.
Sure.
Right.
Great. Thanks for that call, John. So, Corey, ants, ants are somewhat easy to overlook unless they're overrunning the kitchen or the picnic, but they also do figure in a lot of proverbs and folktales and things like that. And not very recently, but in the last decade or so, there was the movie Ants, and also A Bug's Life featured ants. Do you think that those, especially those popular culture portrayals, kind of help foster interest in ants?
Absolutely. And I wonder if the movies foster the interest, or if, sort of our innate interest in what's around us, and the fact that we actually encounter ants is what fosters the movies. So I actually argue that ants are one of the best groups of organisms to study on the planet, because anywhere you live, except Antarctica, and people don't actually live there without some help, you can find ants. And so even if you live in a very urban environment, you can study ants on the sidewalk or in your backyard. And so I think they're a great group, especially for kids, because it's much more close to their eye level often, to sort of start observing, animals doing things mm-hmm. in their natural environment.
Well, and that's an interesting point, Corey, because being able to see ants in the wild without having to, go on a big expedition generally is a great thing. What about things like ant farms? Do you think that those are good or not so good?
I'm actually a fan of ant farms, especially because it gets people to start thinking about ants as more than just pests, that, and to start observing, what animals are doing. And so, watching an ant, searching for food, even if it's within an ant farm, it sort of puts those organisms into a new context. People start feeling much more badly about spraying insecticide on them in their yards if they start to observe them more.
Ron in Evansville has a question or comment. Hi, Ron.
Yes, very interesting. In the Bible, it says in the book of Proverbs, to go to the ant, thou sluggard, and consider, then it says, her ways. So I found it interesting. The Bible calls the ants we see female. And then also that uses the ant as a role model for people, how that they need to be busy about their business. And, of course, I also have an interest in the Bible in many ways, but one because of the scientific accuracy of all of its statements of science. So I found it interesting that the Bible identifies the ants we see as female.
That's a really interesting comment.
That is.
And was that something that you were familiar with, Corey?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, it's one of those, well-quoted proverbs that people love to use. And although it's nice that they definitely got the gender correct, I'm always torn as to whether we should actually follow the ways of ants, right? I mean, there are many species in which you could say, oh, we'll be more industrious. And I think that's sort of what that proverb mm-hmm. is referring to. But there are species of ants that do all kinds of odd things that I wouldn't necessarily like to see humans mirroring.
And even just the ripping off your wings to start breeding doesn't sound like a great thing to be following. Thanks for that call, Ron. Mark in Racine has something to say. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Hi.
I'd like you to comment on the evolution of ants. They came originally from wasps, I believe.
That's right.
Secondly, I've been a lifelong observer of nature, and something I've often seen during the summers, middle to late summer, is ant colonies having apparent battles. There will be two two swaths of them, and then there will be a battlefront where they're wrestling with each other and carrying each other off. I was wondering what the resolution of such a war is. Does one colony become subordinate to another, or pheromonically, or do they? Does one colony kill off the other?
So in those cases, those are usually skirmishes over sort of foraging rights, right? So you're essentially establishing your space. And so you can imagine that with a colony with, you know, hundreds to thousands of individuals, you have to have enough, you know, sort of area to go out and find food resources. And so what happens as colonies grow is that they start to encounter each other more often as they're out foraging for food resources. So during those skirmishes, they're essentially establishing a boundary line. Now, each colony is always trying to push that boundary further, you know, forward in their own benefit. And so what happens is you'll often find, you know, dead individuals piled up at those boundaries. And that species of ant that we often see, the pavement ants, that's an unusual species of ants where they will actually battle until death. Most ants actually, like most animals in the world, when you have these battles, it's always sort of more of a show of dominance, right? Who's bigger, who's tougher? You're sort of sizing each other up. And so although you will at times have colonies pushed back so severely that then they then can't forage for enough resources that they then are subsumed into the, you know, the biomass of the world, but they're not usually trying to take over the other colony.
Thanks for that call. And Corey Moreau is our guest today. She is the curator, an assistant curator in the Department of Zoology at Chicago's Field Museum of Natural History. She is the focus of the Romance of Ants exhibit. And we are going to be talking more with Corey. If you would like to join in, please give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@WPR. Stay tuned here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and we're talking with Corey Moreau from the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago. She is an ant expert, and we're talking about ants, and we're also going to talk about how to encourage and support the interest in science and nature of young people, which is a big focus, actually, of the Romance of Ants exhibit. And I want to make sure people know that the Romance of Ants exhibit is at the Field Museum until January 1st of 2012, so a few more months to catch that if you're in the area. Corey, are there other insects that we might mistake for an ant? What are the characteristics that define anthood?
One of the things that for the average person who's not looking at an ant through a microscope is I tell people to look for elbowed antennae. So it sort of looks like, you know, they have an antennae with a distinct break in it. In addition, ants usually have a sort of constriction in their waist, so you'll see that there's sort of a tightening at their waist, and they'll usually have a node or a petiole, we call it, either one or two there. So those are sort of the best ways to sort of identify ants. The other thing is that ants rarely are out foraging alone, right? So if you spend enough time looking, you'll usually see more than one individual. The only things that people tend to confuse with ants are things that usually mimic ants. And so there are a whole suite of organisms, from spiders through true bugs through beetles, that actually try to look a lot like an ant. Because things that eat ants, usually avoid ants because you never encounter one. So you mess with one and suddenly you have dozens of them swarming you. So these other insects use that to their benefit. By looking like an ant, things will avoid them.
Eric and Madison emailed to ask or to say, I've been finding large black ants with wings hiding under anything on the floor in my bedroom on the second floor. And I'm guessing that Eric is wondering how he can get rid of those.
Yes. Well, so it sounds to me like there is a chance that they could be carpenter ants. And so what you want to do is either have someone identify those, maybe contact somebody, an entomologist at a local university or museum. The other thing is you may actually ask an exterminator to come take a look. I'm not always the biggest fan of having chemicals brought into our homes, but in the case of carpenter ants, because they can do structural damage to your home, it's probably a good idea.
Great. And let's go to Mike in Milwaukee, who's with us by phone. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Mike.
Oh, hi, Judith, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask, I understand that nursery worker ants secrete an antimicrobial substance on ant larvae to protect them from infection. And I was wondering, is there any interest in harvesting ants for possible medicinal application to human health?
That's a great question. So, I mean, one of the things we do know is that since ants live in these tight quarters that are often below ground and in these, you know, humid, dark areas, things like bacterial and fungal infections can be a high probability. So ants have a special organ on their body just to excrete antimicrobial and antifungal substances. People have sort of talked about looking at them for, you know, human applications, and I'm not sure how far that's gone. But I do know that, you know, we have found other, you know, other groups of peoples around the world have medicinal uses for ants. And so one of those, you know, classic examples is that people in South America, indigenous groups, if they hurt themselves terribly in the forest, they'll go on a hunt and for army ants because the workers have very enlarged mandibles, and they can use those as sort of living sutures. They get them to bite closed both sides of their wound, twist off the body, leaving just a head capsule with those jaws pinching your wound together, and you can leave them there until your wound heals.
That's really interesting, and I'm assuming that other indigenous groups probably have other uses for ants as well.
That's right, and so one of the things we know is that indigenous groups in South America, I'm sorry, in the southern U.S. and into Mexico, as well as an independent group of Aborigines in Australia, dig up a group of ants called honeypot ants, and these are ants that are found in arid environments, and they have individuals within their nests that are essentially storage chambers for liquid food. And that's usually in the form of things like nectar. So you have these, you know, individuals with these enlarged abdomens that are holding nothing but essentially a sugar water. So indigenous groups and also all kinds of animals, if they encounter one of these nests, will dig them up and eat this sweet little nutrient treat. And they're essentially what I call desert M&Ms. It's a nice little treat to find in an environment where you wouldn't expect to find them.
Let's go to Paul in Madison next. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. And what's your question?
I'm sorry?
What's your question?
Oh, the question? Fire ants. I've always lived in the South, and they're just everywhere. And I'm wondering, can they be used for anything, farmed for anything, to help control other insects, things like that? And also, I've always heard that they can take down a cow and kill a cow. Are they that deadly?
So the ants that you more likely encounter in the South in such high densities are unfortunately non-native invasive ants, and those are the red imported fire ant. And it's a situation in which, you know, we've inadvertently introduced them here in the United States, and they've spread quite quickly. But they can't really take down a cow. There actually are a group of wasps that are, you know, have a common name called a cow killer, because it's thought that their sting is so painful that it'll kill a cow. But that's not entirely true. So they wouldn't really take down any kind of livestock other than if they were in a tight pen and couldn't get away. Maybe they could go into anaphylactic shock if they were stung too much. But, you know, taking advantage of ants in the environment to control other insects, although we can't do it with the fire ants in the South, citrus farmers in Southeast Asia and in northern parts of Australia actually do use ants as sort of a natural insecticide. So what they'll do is they'll move a particular species of ant's nest into their citrus tree and allow the ants to live there. And what the ants do is patrol that citrus tree nonstop and keep every other kind of pest insect off of that plant. And so that's a way in which we can use them as sort of a natural biocontrol.
Thanks for that call, Paul. And let's go to Joan in Dodgeville. Hi, Joan. Joan?
Hello?
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I have a friend who insists that there is a species of ants called piss ants. And if you have a rash on your arm, maybe a few little red dots that's itchy, she says that this ant has caused this to happen. And I maintain that there's no such ant. And I want to know if indeed there are ants that walk over you and dribble their formic acid upon you and create rashes like that.
All right, Joan, thanks for that question. And Corey, what's the verdict?
Well, so, you know, there are things that people call piss ants. It's actually not one kind of ant. So pretty much any continent you go, somebody has something they call a piss ant. And even here in the United States, if you were to sort of pull people from different parts of the country, everybody would swear that they had a piss ant, and they would all be different. So I think it's just one of those sort of urban legends that we've all hung on to. As far as the rash, that's highly unlikely. I mean, you'd have to have a large number of ants walking over you and without you noticing, and that, so that sounds really unlikely. And they wouldn't really be just dribbling their formic acid everywhere. So ants really reserve that because it's costly to make inside their bodies unless they're being attacked or they're subduing prey.
So it's the formic acid is a defense.
That's right, and it's only found in some ants. Other ants have actually a venom gland, which, like, much like their wasp ancestors, that they have a sting to deliver that venom.
Thanks for that question, Joan. Corey, you had mentioned earlier, I think it was vampire ants?
That's right. And so,
or Dracula ants? What are they called?
Well, they can actually be called either.
Okay.
And so that's actually one of the first groups of ants that I worked on, and I worked on that when I was a master's student at the California Academy of the Sciences. And actually, Dracula ants are featured in our Romance of Ants exhibit here at the Field Museum. And so this is a group of ants in which they have an unusual way of getting their protein source. So typically when you see an ant out foraging in the environment, the reason they're out hunting and dragging that food item back to their nest is that ants have a really tight constriction in their waist. I sort of mentioned that earlier about the identification. So it makes swallowing large solid food items near impossible. So although they can lick up liquid sources of food anywhere they find them, swallowing those large protein packages is hard. So the reason they drag it back to their nest is to feed it to the larvae. Now, the larvae haven't gone through complete metamorphosis yet, so they don't look anything like an ant. They actually look much more like a fly maggot. So they're essentially a sack with a mouth. So the larvae are functioning as the stomach of the colony. So once that prey item has been fed to the larvae, the adult workers, and the queen in particular who needs protein to keep making all those eggs, can go to the larvae and drum on them with their antennae, and this signals to the larvae to regurgitate some of that food source to the adult. So it's similar to what we see in other groups of ants in sort of social food sharing, much like birds where there you have the adults regurgitating to the young. Here you have the young regurgitating to the adults. But in the Dracula ants, once they've fed that food item to the larvae will not share that food item back with the adult workers. So in order to get any of that protein source back, they have to use their jaws or mandibles to bite a hole in the integument or skin of the larvae and lick up the exuding hemolymph or blood. Now, this is considered non-destructive cannibalism, even though they're feeding on the blood of their own young, because it doesn't seem to harm the larvae. They'll continue to go through successive molts and eventually emerge as healthy workers. And so that's where they get their common name, Dracula ants, or you can call them vampire ants.
Wow, that's really fascinating. Let's go to Bill in Portage. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
See, I've got a slab of concrete between the house and the garage. And for the last, in that concrete slab are relief cuts, so that if it cracks, it'll hopefully crack along those cuts.
Mm-hmm.
For the last 3 years, I've had a swarm of ants comes out of one of those cracks. I don't know what time of day. I mean, it's as the sun is setting, and it has to be at a certain point, and then all of a sudden they appear. And they just kind of swarm around this crack, both sides of it, maybe up to an area as big as 10 inches out from that crack. They're, you know, probably within a foot, foot and a half of the grass, but they don't go into the lawn.
Mm-hmm.
There's no food source there, but they run around like crazy, and I have no idea what they're doing. I'm curious if maybe your guest has an idea.
Thanks, Bill. Corey, what do you think they're up to?
So it could be one of two things. It could be if you see any individuals with wings, it could be that they're getting ready to send those sexual forms off into the environment to have their mating swarm. But more likely what you're seeing are two nests that are living underneath the ground, probably underneath those concrete slabs in the soil. And they're actually, that's a contact zone you're seeing. So you're seeing two colonies that are essentially battling it out for foraging rights to that region as well as lots of other areas below ground.
Great. Thanks for that call. And Corey, I want to make sure that we talk a little bit about the exhibit itself, because the Romance of Ants is really entertaining in large part because the whole exhibit takes the person that's at the exhibit into a graphic novel that's of your life.
That's right.
And I found on the Field Museum website that there's a free download of the graphic novel. Actually, I posted that link on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show, so anyone can go there and download it. I think it's especially great to share with young people because it starts with you as a little girl growing up in New Orleans, and you were interested in nature and animals, but you were in a very urban environment. So what did you do?
I spent a lot of time watching ants on the sidewalk or any other insect I could find or catch or put in a jar or, you know, and I took, you know, all kinds of fastidious notes in my little notebooks about what I saw them doing.
And recruited your little brother, as I recall.
That's right. And so my little brother got dragged along quite often. So I certainly wish I had those notebooks still. But I think that's one of the charms of this exhibit at the Field Museum is that we sort of combined not only these larger-than-life color photographs of ants up close so you can actually see all the structures on them with the story of sort of how I went from being a little girl watching ants on the sidewalk through sort of following a career path to eventually becoming an entomologist here at the Field Museum. And so that story in, you know, is told in this black and white comic book style. Actually, I've been surprised when we first came up with the idea, the exhibits team here at the Field Museum, to implement this, I thought for sure this would really be a draw for children. And although that's certainly been true, I actually get quite a lot of feedback from adults who actually were really drawn into the story or didn't realize that science actually goes on behind the scenes at places like the Field Museum.
And so fast forwarding from that, you know, childhood interest, I think it talks about you at seven, then you go through, you know, adolescence and have a little trouble with, you know, being into science, not being cool for a girl, but then you eventually come back to it. And it was really kind of stumbling into a biology class that kind of cemented it for you.
That's right. And so, you know, I always tell people that part of the reason I think I became a scientist was because of PBS. And, you know, growing up in an urban environment, I didn't really know that, you know, there was so much diversity out there. I also didn't know that there could be a lot of, you know, jobs for scientists. And so, you know, watching, you know, things on television, it was well before the Discovery Channel and Animal mm-hmm. Planet, you know, that was my only source. And so I spent a lot of time watching those kind of programs. And so, like you mentioned, I was very enthralled with nature as a child. I think as most kids are, anytime they see something, you know, moving on the sidewalk, they'll take a few moments to watch. But, you know, it wasn't really cool for girls to like science and math and bugs in particular in your junior high school days. And so, I mean, it wasn't an inadvertent peer pressure that, you know, forced me to sort of take that passion and put it underground. But, you know, I felt it, and so I sort of succumbed to that. And it wasn't until I went away to college that I walked into my first biology class, and it was just sort of like the floodgates being reopened. And it wasn't just that I knew I wanted to do science. I knew I wanted to study ants. And so that was really part of what drove me to go to San Francisco State University, was so I could pursue a degree in entomology.
Last week, Larry talked with the organizers of the National Science Olympiad, which brought 7,000 kids, parents, and teachers to UW-Madison for the competition. And the kids' excitement was really something to see. You would see kind of herds of them going up and down the streets and running from building to building.
Yeah.
What do you think parents, teachers, and other adults can do to encourage and really foster a passion for nature and science in children, and especially in girls?
I think sort of, you know, it's difficult because we don't often do things with awareness when we're inadvertently stifling things or, you know, putting these messages in that girls shouldn't like science. It's much more subtle. So I think really finding ways to encourage them to just stay engaged and doing things like taking them to natural history museums is a great way. Making sure they're involved with camps in the summer that get them outdoors. Going on hikes in trails and parks near your home are always good. Just taking time to, you know, look at the birds outside on the bird feeder. All of those things ingrain that sort of passion for the natural world and bring it out. And so I think that, you know, there are many ways to get your kids engaged in academic pursuits that include things like science in your community. And mm-hmm. so sort of seeking those out is always a great idea.
Maybe an ant farm for a gift sometime, too.
That's right. And in fact, you know, ant farms are a great way to sort of get kids looking at things that they may not otherwise
right.
encounter. And in the Romance of Ants exhibit here at the Field Museum, we have a giant ant farm that's actually embedded in a green glowing agar that the ants can tunnel through and eat. And this is the same kind of agar you can get in most ant farms now. And it's spelled out in the word ants.
Great. And we do have time for a couple more calls. So let's go back to the phones. Alan in La Crosse wants to join in. Hi, Alan.
Years ago, when I was a kid, they used to sell what they called ant farms. It was a square plastic cube, and then you could look through them and watch them work and all that kind of stuff.
That's right.
I wonder if I haven't seen them, though. I wonder if they still can buy them or anywhere or what.
You absolutely can. And in fact, They sell the traditional ant farms like you're talking, where usually it was with some sort of a soil or sand you would put in them. But now you can even get them with that sort of green agar or blue agar, all different colors that I was mentioning that we have in the exhibit here at the Field Museum. So you can find them still in all kinds of children's toy shops, as well as online, and we sell them here at the Field Museum as well as part of the exhibit.
Great. So, Alan, you'll have to go out and buy one for old time's sake. Gail in Door County, on to you. Hi, Gail.
Hi. I have a might be an unusual question, but since the author, the woman is so into ants, have you ever had them in chocolate? You know, when the big craze was to chocolate-covered
ants.
The insects. And if you have, what ones, like, can you eat or shouldn't you eat? And if you know how to do that, can you give some people the recipe? If they have a lot of ants, maybe they can catch them and make them into candies.
That's right.
So well, and I have to say, in a lot of cultures, eating insects is more than acceptable. It's a treat.
That's right. And so I think that, you know, in the United States, it's less common that we eat insects. But worldwide, as you mentioned, many people eat all kinds of different insects, from, you know, all kinds of large beetle larvae through ants themselves and the larvae that we find inside their nests. And so there are, I bet you if you went online, you'd find all kinds of recipes for how to prepare things. Like, they have chocolate chirp cookies where you put crickets in them and chocolate-covered ants. And you know, I have tried them here or there, but more often than not, I actually get given them as gifts.
Because people think you should like them, whether
That's
you
right.
do or not. Steve in Lake Geneva, we're on to you. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I was just wondering, I work at a restaurant, and we didn't have an ant problem before, and we called Orkin to prevent the ants from coming, and now all of a sudden, just ants just showed up, and we have kind of an infestation from it.
Well, that's unfortunate. I don't think there's a correlation, unless you have a really odd pest control guy who's, you know, planting them in your restaurant, but which I doubt is happening. But I think it's more correlation. It also has to do with the time of the year. So in the early spring, when all that rain happens, that's actually when most people start having ant problems in their home, because as that soil becomes so saturated, the ants are having a hard time living in it. They start pushing up into people's homes and basements and, in your case, restaurants. So,
well, and I also wonder, Corey, could it be that some predators were killed off, and so the ants kind of have free reign?
Maybe, but I mean, one of the things that we don't find as often is that, you know, that one particular predator is keeping all ants under control and sort of, you know, using some sort of a pesticide that's going to have them spring up that quickly. It would take a much longer amount of time. And so if you go to the Romance of Ants website, which is www.romanceofants.com, we have not only cool facts, but we have an Ask a Question section. And on there, we had someone inquire about how to get rid of ants in their kitchens and yard. And so there's actually a great explanation on how to do that.
And I bet a lot of people will be appreciating that right about now. I have to say, our kitchen is getting a little bit overrun with the really tiny little ants.
Oh, that's right. We'll all have these problems.
Well, Corey, the time has just flown by. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure.
It's been really great. Corey Moreau is an assistant curator in the Department of Zoology at Chicago's Field Museum of Natural History. She's not only the curator of The Romance of Ants, but is also a starring part of it. And that exhibit is at the Field Museum in Chicago until January 1st of 2012. We are going to come back in just a couple minutes with staffers from the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. And I hope you'll stay tuned here on the Ideas Network.